city with a plastic trash bag taped over the passenger's window. I auditioned for a 24-year-old director named John Singleton for his film Poetic Justice. After I finished my reading, I looked at John squarely. "LaBoy, just give me the fucking part, will you?" He said, "Yes, ma'am." I turned and walked out to the waiting room, grinning smugly at the three or four women waiting to audition. "Y'all might as well go home, because I got this bitch." Like I said, therapy doesn't work right away. Poetic Justice starred Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur, the hip-hop legend. I played the mother of Tupac's character. Of course, I had been a fan of Janet's for years, but Tupac and the whole rap thing were pretty foreign to me. Mostly, I associated the hip-hop scene with guns and danger. The day we were set to shoot our scene together, I walked to Tupac's trailer to rehearse. I could hear the music pounding before my knock was answered by an 18-year-old girl in hot pants and bikini top. As she opened the door, a huge cloud of weed smoke engulfed me. I entered the trailer, and I swear, there must have been 8 girls in there. The smoke was thick, the music was deafening, and I felt intimidated by Tupac's thuggy bodyguards and their tattoos. I stood there a second, not knowing what to do. Then I guess the contact high kicked in, because I shouted over the music, "You motherfuckers get the hell out! This son of a bitch has to rehearse!" There was a moment of shocked silence. Then Tupac said, "Oh, man, I love her. Y'all get the fuck out of here." We rehearsed, then shot our scene. Tupac was a total professional. A very, very impressive young man. 1993 was one of the biggest years of my career. I was still filming What's Love Got to Do with It when the producers from In Living Color came to see The Diva Is Dismissed at the Hudson. They asked me to bring 2 of my characters from Diva to their comedy sketch show. My contributions to In Living Color were Snooki, "Who's a woman gotta sleep with to get something to eat?" and Mrs. Sheridan. That just proves my point. The Wayans brothers had left by then, so unfortunately I didn't get to work with any of them. But Jim Carrey, Jamie Foxx, and Takiya Crystal Kamar were still there, and we had a blast. I had steady work as a regular on A Different World and was filming Poetic Justice. I also had a small part in Robert Townsend's Meteor Man and rejoined Whoopi as her backup singer in Sister Act 2. Whoopi was in the middle of doing The Whoopi Goldberg Show, a late-night talk show that ran for about a year. She called me. "Come on down to the studio and hang out." When I pulled up to the studio, Eartha Kitt was leaving, and Patti LaBelle was pulling up in a Rolls Royce. Now, take a deep breath, close your eyes, and imagine. Eartha Kitt, Patti LaBelle, and Jennifer Lewis occupying the same space. When Patti saw me, she said to Whoopi, "Ain't she the dean?" It was a lovely day. Whoopi got married on October 1st, 1986. The celebs poured in. Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Richard Pryor, Mark Hamill, Ray Liotta, John Voight, and certainly, most impressively, Jennifer Lewis. I went upstairs and zipped Whoopi into her pretty dress. And we had a good laugh that she had the words, fuck you, spelled out on her rooftop for the paparazzi. Whoopi has always had my best interest at heart. I've been lucky for the most part in terms of the quality of my friendships. I believe the company you keep is incredibly important. I have surrounded myself with loving, giving people. And of course they had to be smart and talented. One morning I went to Whoopi's trailer on the set of Karina Karina. I was crying and I told her I needed to get Ricky, someone I was dating and had allowed to move in with me, out of my house. And I didn't know how. The next day was per diem day. I went to Whoopi's trailer to rehearse the scene and saw $2,000 cash sitting on her coffee table. I said, girl, why you got all this money sitting around? I'm gonna steal this shit. She said, you don't have to steal it. It's yours. I said, what? Girl, I don't. She said, take that $2,000 and get that nigga out of your house before it cost you $2 million like it did me. My success in movie and television roles allowed me to become a first-time homeowner. It was a huge deal for a poor girl from Kinloch. I bought a beautiful, spacious condominium in Studio City. I had never lived in anything bigger than a one-bedroom apartment. The living room was huge. There were 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, a pool, and a tennis court. It seemed so cavernous. Look, I'm not gonna lie to y'all. It scared me a little bit, okay? I slept in the smallest bedroom for a long time. I had a mortgage. I now belonged to the Homeowners Association. I had 2 parking spaces. No more of that parking on the street shit where somebody steals your car, takes it on a joyride, and 3 days later, the police return it with Taco Bell wrappers in the backseat. Assholes. I bought a new Camry. The only precious possession I brought with me from the bungalow to the condo was an upright piano. I had been sleeping on a futon and was looking forward to new, more grown-up furniture. My cousin Ronnie came from Kinloch to help me get the place together. I went antiquing with Whoopi and Santa Barbara. We saw a sofa I admired. The next day it was delivered to my house, a gift from Whoopi. I also employed my first housekeeper. However, once you've been a have-not, you're forever subject to moments that take you back. Gladys, my housekeeper, would bring her son along as she worked in my condo. Being with them made me melancholy and nostalgic, recalling the occasions when I went to work with my mother as she cleaned white people's homes. Journal entry. Getting my ass kicked in Hollywood sometimes feels like getting my ass kicked in Kinloch. I've been trying to kill myself for 33 years. I awoke choking on my very crime. I took a little vacation to St. Martin with Deborah Dean Davis. She was always trying to get me to try new activities so I'd have something to focus on besides my career and therapy. This was the reason we lay inappropriately on the beach, naked, for all to see. I was 35 years old, a brick house in these streets. 36, 24, 36, with skin like a baby's ass. Almond eyes, perfect nose, black girl lips in full throttle. Titties up! Well, sagging a little. ass tight, and pretty feet. That's right, goddammit. Look at me and get your life. Journal entry. Stop waiting for something or someone to come and make you happy. Meditate daily. Breathe. Come on. You're okay, Jenny. You have friends. Love them. Respect them. Go out and play. Learn to be alone. I experienced a breakthrough in my psychological health when I got into a big argument with a makeup artist friend named Sherry. It marked the first time a friend asked me to sit down and work through a problem rather than allow me or them to storm off. She was in therapy, too, for an eating disorder. We both used the tools therapy had given us and processed our issues with each other. This was an important moment in my life because it also showed how I was attracting more positive and adult people in my life. When I went to my next therapy session, I was proud to tell Rachel how I had worked through a disagreement with a friend in a healthy way. Therapy is a bumpy bitch, but it continues to unfold if you stick with it. I was starting to understand more of who I was taking into the audition rooms with me, and it allowed my career to grow. I stopped being so arrogant. I was dismissing the diva, ripping off the mask to show my true self. But it sure wasn't easy. 12. Kicking down doors. The artificial glitz of Hollywood is the least of living in Los Angeles. God spread her glory in this city, being generous with the bling of palms, golden sunshine, crashing ocean, and nearby mountains, and of course, the purple jacaranda trees in May. Despite my moments of sadness, madness, and ambition, I aligned myself with nature like never before. Mother Nature had a surprise for me. The violent shaking started at 4:30 a.m. on January 17, 1994. Tai Chi and yoga had taught me to go limp in these kinds of situations. I was still sleeping on the low futon-style bed, so I had nothing to fall from, but I was thrown over the thing like a rag doll. This was not my first earthquake, but it was the strongest I had ever felt. The shaking seemed to go on forever. When it finally stopped, I was relieved to be in one piece, unhurt. I reached down and found the clothes I had dropped next to the bed the night before. There were matches in my pants pocket, and foolishly, I did something you should not do in the aftermath of an earthquake. Light a match. This could ignite any gas that had been released into the air. In the few seconds the match was aglow, I could see the ceiling had dropped a little and was about to crash on to my bed. Everything was broken and scattered about, and I felt the cool January air coming through the broken windows. I blew out the match, and in complete darkness, blindly felt my way toward the living room. My upright Yamaha piano had fallen over, and there was a wall in the way, but somehow I squeezed through. My phone rang. It was my brother, Larry, calling from Missouri. He was heading out early for his job teaching at Jennings High School when the news of the quake came over the radio. It's bad. It's real bad. Don't tell Mama. I'm okay. But it's so fucking bad. I whispered to him because the silence in the moment was so great around me, I felt compelled to keep my own voice low. Mother Nature had just kicked our ass. I called Rachel. She lived just down the street. I was relieved to hear she was fine. The phone went dead. I went outside into the corridor that opened onto a courtyard. Across the way lived an 80-year-old couple. I went to check on them. They were shaken, of course, but alive. They had a flashlight, which I asked for, so I can help these other people. I was now hearing screams for help. I went to open one neighbor's door, only to find it was stuck. Without hesitation, I yelled, "Stand back from the door!" It was as if my entire molecular structure suddenly recalled the moves I had learned at the karate dojo when I lived with Miguel and his mother. I unleashed a powerful forward snap kick, which knocked open the door. A couple crawled out. I repeated the kick 5 more times that night. It was like I was in a Bruce Lee movie. Adrenaline or some force greater activated inside of me. I found my neighbor Tina underneath 2 curio cabinets that had collapsed over her head, forming a steeple in midair. Shards of glass stuck out from the cabinets, one just inches from Tina's neck. I said, "Don't move, Tina." I put the flashlight in my mouth and oh so carefully moved the shard away from her throat. Some young men appeared, and I asked them to help move the cabinet so she could get free while I went off to the next apartment. In the midst of kicking down doors, I paused to look up. I saw stars in the sky like I'd never seen before. In the absence of electric lights, I saw the Milky Way in all its splendor. I said a prayer of thanks. Everybody in our complex had helped each other and made it out safely. We stood in the street together, crying, praying. When the sun came up, we learned the enormity of the disaster. The quake measured 6.7 on the Richter scale, and 52 people died. I figured our building would be condemned, and a few days later, documents posted on the front door made it official. FEMA would be placing us in temporary housing. Just a few weeks after the earthquake, I was asked to step in for disco queen Donna Summer at a fundraising concert for AIDS Project Los Angeles. The AIDS crisis was rampaging, and Hollywood royalty came out in droves that night. Whitney Houston, Elizabeth Taylor, Jennifer Holliday, Madonna, and countless more stars were there to honor entertainment idols whose lives were taken by the epidemic, including Rock Hudson, Robert Mapplethorpe, and Freddie Mercury. Scott Whitman and Mark Shaiman directed the show. My performance recognized Paul Jabara, the brilliant composer who wrote disco hits like Last Dance, It's Raining Men, and the duet Enough is Enough, which was a huge success for Barbra Streisand and Donna Summer. When I took the stage accompanied by a 60-piece orchestra, 3 backup singers, and a half dozen dancers, I could see 2 of my biggest idols, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barbara Streisand sitting next to each other, fifth row center. As one might expect, my performance was highly energetic and highly irreverent. My first words were, "They couldn't get the bitch," referring to the fact I was singing Donna's songs. When I got to the part in the Jabara medley where I would sing Barbara Streisand's verse in Enough is Enough, I deliberately missed a note. Walking to the front of the stage to address Miss Streisand, I said,
"Barbara, can you help me with this note, honey?"
When I saw Barbara and Hillary turn to one another and laugh, my life was complete, and I got the first standing ovation of the night. At the after party, Babs came over to see me. All right, I pushed my way through the crowd so I could stand next to her. Now, everybody knows Barbara Streisand is a germaphobe. So when she placed her hand on my cheek, wow, I was deeply touched. She said, "You are so special." Wow, I had been dubbed by the queen herself and never washed my face again. Seriously, though, I must have been really special that night, because it just so happened that Rachel was at the show. At our next session, she told me she wanted me to begin taking add-on medication to rein in my manic behavior. Also, Rachel and I agreed I needed a focus outside of work and myself. See, most entertainers spend a lot of time either being the center of attention or seeking to be the center of attention. We can lose perspective, thinking everything is about us. Fortunately, I had a strong circle of support around me. Friends like Jeffrey Gunter and Kiki Shepherd, Ron Glass, and, of course, Roxanne helped me to stay on track. Plus, my cousin, Willetta Harmon, had moved to L.A. from Kinloch, and she was a steady, loving force. While I was filming Panther with Kadeem Hardison, I arrived on set one day, and Dick Gregory was there. What a wonderful surprise. Dick was a giant in the realms of social justice and entertainment, and like me, he was from Kinloch. I was eager to speak with him about nutrition. About 10 years earlier, Dick had created the Slim Safe Bahamian Diet in response to the appalling health status of African Americans. The diet became a sensation in the black community because it reflected our culture and traditions around food. My conversation with Dick was a timely reminder of the importance of eating right for my mind and my body. That summer, I went on a study tour of Egypt with the acclaimed Egyptologist, Professor Asa Hilliard. Dr. Hilliard was also known as Nana Bafour Amonkhawtia III. Provided an Afrocentric perspective on the history of this once great empire. As we visited the Great Pyramid of Giza and the open markets in Cairo and viewed 2,000-year-old ceiling paintings in the Temple of Karnak, Dr. Hilliard demonstrated that the roots of modern civilization lie in Africa, not Greece or Rome. While we were in Cairo, I scheduled a massage. The masseuse was a young and, of course, fine Egyptian man. He truly worked out my knots. He was so good that I scheduled a follow-up massage, fully intending to fuck him. But I was conflicted. Rachel and I recently had talked about how others can't rescue you. So I tried to work through the situation by writing about it in my journal. After a couple of drinks, I called Rachel to talk me out of it. Jennifer, it's 3 a.m. in Los Angeles.
I'm sorry, Rachel, but I'm gonna have sex with this man.
No, you're not. She hung up. Rachel was not suffering my foolishness. And I did not fuck the masseuse. I returned to the States only to learn from my answering machine that 4 friends had died from AIDS while I was away. I called my eternally wise acting teacher, Janet Alhanty, and said, "What do you do with this? How do you mourn 4 friends at once?" She said, "You live it. You just have to live it." I was dealing with so much loss and so many abandonment issues that I couldn't comfortably be alone. I would hang out with the boat or my gypsy friends as much as possible. I spent a lot of time with Michael Peters, who had moved to Los Angeles. We had gone together to Joshua Tree National Park, where the Mojave and Colorado deserts meet. Amid the beauty of Joshua Tree, Michael told me he'd been suffering with HIV/AIDS for quite some time. To come home from Egypt and hear he'd made his transition was almost too much to bear. We celebrated him like the king of dance that he was. At dinner one night with Marta Kaufman and Michael Skloff, the conversation, of course, turned to Friends, the sitcom Marta and her partner David Crane had created. Michael wrote the opening theme music, and my friend Allie Willis wrote the lyrics, "I'll be there for you." Naturally, I ask, "Is there anybody black on the show?" And ladies and gentlemen, that's how I became the first black person on Friends. I played Paula, a chef working at the restaurant with Courtney Cox's character. I was taking my medication regularly. There were side effects, including dry mouth and a loss of sexual appetite, which was a blessing. Well, so much for my sex addiction. My psychiatrist worked with me to adjust the dosage. It took patience. Patience? Patience to get the medication right. Don't walk into a doctor's office and think they're gonna fix your shit overnight. You can't take a cocktail of pills and know immediately what the results are going to be. I feel fortunate that psychiatric medicines have become sophisticated enough that doctors can customize various kinds of drugs and dosages for each person. Oh, and please remember, I am not pushing drug treatment. I'm telling you my story. My song. The best effect of the meds was that when the phone rang with bad news, I wasn't going to fall apart emotionally. My responses were no longer as extreme. No matter what big issue or catastrophe loomed, I could say, bring it, feel it, and move forward like an adult. I was better able to listen and be present and aware of the world around me. I have learned that meditation works best when you create a calm atmosphere for yourself. You have to slow your roll, give yourself quiet time, and stop to smell the roses, thorns and all. At the New York premiere of the film Waiting to Exhale, Layla Rashan sat on one side of me, and Loretta Devine was on the other. Whitney was behind me on the right, sitting next to Angela, behind me on the left. I was surrounded by friends who starred in the film that I had not gotten a part in. I came home insanely depressed, but then felt very proud of myself because I actually got out of bed, grabbed my journal, and sat with my feelings as Rachel has suggested. Must have worked because I had a great time on the Preacher's Wife set the next day. Whitney and I took to each other like eggs and bacon. Lordy! We laughed, sang, and acted a fool together. I loved Whitney. Not only for her extraordinary talents, but for her warmth and humor. The Preacher's Wife was shot mostly in Yonkers, New York, during terrible winter weather. One morning I sat in the chilly hair and makeup trailer preparing for a scene with Whitney. Just as the stylist finished teasing my hair to the roof, I was notified that Whitney had phoned and would not be appearing for work that day. Therefore, I would have to shoot a different scene that required a completely different hairdo. Okay, I was furious. The stylist would have to wash and restyle my hair. I was already cold, and the small heater in the trailer would never get the area warm enough for me to sit there with wet hair. After a miserable hour of shivering while my hair was redone, I called Whitney's private number. Hello? Hi, baby. It's Jennifer. Oh, Mama, I can't come to work today. There's too much snow. But you should have called 2 hours ago, Whitney. I had to sit in that freezing-ass trailer with my wet head because you called so late. I probably caught my death of cold. But we couldn't even get the car down the driveway. Listen, little girl, this ain't no concert tour, okay? This is making movies. This is teamwork. This is not the Whitney Show. You have to think about people who you're working with. Oh, please, Mama, I won't do it no more. It won't happen again. Mama, don't be mad. Mama. How could I be mad? I knew she heard me and was sorry. It became more and more clear that Whitney carried heavy burdens. Later that week, we were shooting at a pier on the Hudson River. I could see that something wasn't right with Whitney that day. I didn't know what. She looked beautiful in her wardrobe, but seemed troubled and disconnected. I said to her, "You know, Whitney, I went to therapy to take care of a lot of my challenges, and baby, you know," before I could say another word, she whipped her head around and said, "Oh, no, Mama. My Lord Savior Jesus Christ, take care of me." She said it with such fervor and determination that I never brought it up again. The next summer, Whitney invited me to Jersey and gave me the grand tour of her house. Her sweet little daughter, Bobby Christina, was swimming, so I jumped in. We had fun, but after an hour, I was ready to get out. She, of course, was not, but nevertheless allowed me to wrap her in a big fluffy towel and take her back inside to her talented mama. Whitney and I stayed in touch off and on, but we didn't see each other much. Years later, I was in Atlanta filming Meet the Browns, and Whitney asked me to come to her home for dinner. When I arrived, she was indisposed and could not come down for the meal. I spent the evening with Sissy and Pat, Whitney's mother and sister-in-law. Then, a couple of months before Whitney passed away, she called me. She was very excited about waiting to exhale too, and said that she was on her way to rehab so she would be in top shape to shoot the movie.
I'm gonna do it this time, Mama. Don't worry, this time I'm gonna do it for real.
I never heard Whitney's voice again. But I often recall the day we filmed in the church where she sings. I was giving an interview in the back of the church, and without moving my eyes off Whitney, I said to the journalist, "Her voice is the eighth wonder of the world, and that's all I have to say." I went to a big birthday party given by Carrie Fisher and Penny Marshall, who directed The Preacher's Wife. It was a celebrity-filled affair. In addition to my castmates, Denzel, Whitney, and Loretta, the crowd included Jack Nicholson, Jane Fonda, and Jay Leno. I was excited to meet Carrie, Princess Leia from Star Wars. She, too, lived with bipolar disorder and, similar to me, had turned her story and struggles into art. Oprah Winfrey called and I flew to New York again, this time to participate in a reading of Toni Morrison's Beloved. I was so excited. Oprah put us up at the Four Seasons, and that morning I ordered a $40 frittata. Disgusted at that, but I was happy it gave me energy to face a day with the likes of Samuel L. Jackson, Mary Alice, Tandy Newton, and Oprah. There were about 12 of us sitting around a long table, poised to impress the great one herself. Well, I, for one, had studied my ass off. Now, before my big speech, Oprah and I had been trading side glances, teasing like regular girlfriends about Tandy Newton's character, trying to take Samuel Jackson's character away from Oprah Winfrey's character. In other words, don't let her get your man, girl. We were bonding, and I was very happy that Oprah was so down to earth and playful in real life. But then came time for my big monologue. I took a deep breath, slowed myself, and delivered one of the finest performances of my life. My speech had been so impressive that even the seasoned theater veterans started to applaud the delivery. Oprah clocked this exaggerated praise. Let's just say the girlfriend bonding shit stopped on a dime. I immediately knew I would not, under any circumstances, be cast in Beloved. It was Oprah's first starring role, and experience told me she was not about to let my happy ass upstage her even happier ass. Thomas was back on the scene, and he and I drove from Los Angeles to Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman's beach house in Laguna. We had fun, but we mostly fought. It was all because of that I'm the man bullshit. I'm sorry, baby. Everybody in the world knows I'm the man. How I am not a lesbian, ladies and gentlemen, is beyond me. But when you're a dick diva, you're a dick diva. He left for Detroit, and I flew to Hawaii to hang out with Bette Midler and her family, Mark Shaman, Scott Whitman, and hallelujah, Mr. Bruce Valanche himself. We had an insanely full-out fabulous time. When I returned from the trip, there was sad news from home. One of my favorites among my mother's 8 sisters and 7 brothers passed. Aunt Louise was the first of my grandma's small children to die. My first cousin Carol and her family were living in Compton, so I drove down to be with them. We had always been very close. That month, I had a small meltdown because I hadn't had a job for a while. When you're in therapy, it's often one step forward and 10 steps back. But I didn't give up. There is no elevator to success in health or work. I was climbing the stairs against the winds of life. I responded by getting drunk, going shopping, and buying an electric blue fox coat. Sorry, Peter. Things picked up when, God help me, my new manager, Barry Cross, made a deal with Disney to do the Jennifer Lewis Show, a talk show. To make a long story short, I basically was incapable of asking other people about their lives without going on and on and on and on about my own. The show was a fucking train wreck and was never aired. I told y'all, yeah, I can sing and act and entertain, but apparently I just can't stop talking about myself. Thank goodness the writer Lee Rolls called, and I was off to Vancouver to film An Unexpected Life. In the cast were the great Elaine Stritch, Stalker Channing, S. E. Patha Murkison, Christine Ebersole, and RuPaul. I'm under court order never to reveal stories about the carryings on during that shoot. Ask Ru. I won an audition for a role in an animation created by Eddie Murphy called The PJs. It was a cast of wacky and talented people. Phil Morris's fine ass was doing Eddie Murphy's voice. And even if you listen carefully, you can't tell the difference. I was fired from that job for reasons unknown. I think somebody was having sex with somebody, and before I knew it, somebody else had my job. But I didn't give a fuck, because I had 15 other jobs. To this day, I don't remember doing the Proud Family. There was just a whole lot of shit going on, y'all, and I was in high demand. Thank you, Jesus. The phone rang. And it was Suzanne DePass inquiring about my availability to film a television miniseries called The Temptations. Before flying to Pittsburgh for filming, I took a side trip to the Optimum Health Institute in Lemon Grove, California. They should have called it Wheatgrass, California, 'cause these motherfuckers advised you to put wheatgrass in pretty much every functional hole in your body. Ears, nose, throat, and even the eyes. I was so green, I felt like Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz. You know she never got that green shit off her face, right? I left the health retreat 10 pounds lighter, feeling like I could conquer the world. Then, I made one of the worst decisions of my life. I took myself off my meds. 2 days later, the mania had me zigzagging throughout the Temptations base camp on a vintage Schwinn with Suzanne DePass running behind me screaming, "Get her off that bicycle!" Later, I got on the phone with Rachel, who knew immediately what was up with me. She asked if I was on my meds. I lied and said I had taken them. All the while, I rattled on, excited about the cool 1960s cars they had on the set. That night was, to quote James Weldon Johnson, "blacker than 100 midnights down in the cypress swamp." At 1 a.m., I went down to a local bar and threw back a few too many. How I didn't pass out on the street walking back to the hotel, I'll never know. As I fell face first onto the hotel bed and the room spun around, I had one thought only. I'm in trouble. I turned over to reach for the old phone in that old hotel, in that old smelly room. As I reached, I fell out of the bed and wound up in fetal position on the carpet. The phone had also fallen, and somehow I dialed Rachel's number. It was midnight in Los Angeles. In what seemed to be my darkest hour, I prayed she would answer. When her answering machine picked up, I wailed over and over, "Rachel, I need help." She picked up. "Thank God." I told her I was ready to admit I was sick. I told her I'd gotten off my meds and that I was out of control. I apologized to her for being so rageful in my sessions. I told her I wanted to be well, that I was tired of hurting myself. "I'm ready now, Rachel. This time I'm really ready." It was a huge turning point in my life. Though I had been in therapy for a long while, I don't think I had been honestly serious about the whole thing. Well, now I was. That was the worst night of my life. It was also my proudest moment. I had to settle back into therapy with my newfound promise of being disciplined with my medication. If the breakdown during the temptations had not been enough, the call came that my grandma Small had died. I flew to St. Louis to help comfort her 15 children. 6 sons. Robert, Walter, Roy, Charles, John, and Michael. 9 daughters. Dorothy, Catherine, Rosetta, Jean, Shirley, Gloria, Janice, Margaret, and Mary. My Aunt Louise had already passed. There were 2 sisters as well, Ida Clay and Membry Brown, and 79 grandchildren, 105 great-grandchildren, and 17 great-great-grandchildren. I had written a song about Grandma Small for the show, The Diva is Dismissed. It was everybody's favorite. Staring through the back screen door, I finish my spaghetti plate. She'll be glad when I'm all grown up. My Aunt Rosetta is always late. My Aunt Rosetta is always late. My mama is the oldest of 16 kids, and I'm the baby of 7. Cat Johnny drove a big gray Cadillac, and everybody thought that he was in heaven. Everybody thought that he was in heaven. But my grandma Small, she took care of me. My grandma Small made cabbage for me. My grandma Small took me in. Even when I didn't win. Somebody said the old house was haunted, so I'd go there to play. I'd grab Billy Ray by his checkered shirt. It was a crystal blue sky day. It was a crystal blue sky day. What you want for your birthday, girl? Just a brand new bike. I was 12 years old, my daddy brought it in. Hey, daddy, can't you stay for just one night? Can't you sleep over for just one night? Mm-hmm, grandma small. Mm-hmm, watched over me. Mm-hmm, grandma small. She was always happy to see me. Mm-hmm, grandma small. Took me in. Even when I didn't win. One day after school, I was watching her work in her garden. Mm-hmm, she slipped and fell, so I ran to help. She said, no, child, I don't need to get up. If I can't get up by myself, by myself, my grandma small, took care of me. My grandma small, she was always happy to see me. My grandma small took me in, even when I didn't win. She took me in, even when I didn't win. The next morning I went downtown St. Louis, hoping I could sit on the banks of the Mississippi and do some healing. I walked over the grassy knoll and took in every majestic angle of the St. Louis Arch, gateway to the west. I walked down to the muddy river, sat on the cobblestones which had been laid there by enslaved Africans, and proceeded to have my own pity party. I knew I had to get it out. I cried like a baby. I remembered what my grandmother had said. I don't need to get up if I can't get up by myself. So I stood up and walked. I walked and I walked. With the St. Louis skyline behind me, I realized the past was just that, the past. I needed to get back to Los Angeles, refill my prescriptions, get serious about Pilates, meditate every day, and take care of my health, mentally, physically, and spiritually. My answering machine was full when I got home. There was Whoopi inviting me to her birthday party and Bette Midler asking me to do the Roseanne Barr show with her. I learned I had been cast in Mystery Men as William H. Macy's wife, and Oprah's people called to invite me to the beloved premiere. Life was good. I thought the sky was the limit when I was asked to audition for Castaway, starring Tom Hanks. Tom fucking Hanks. Thank you, Mississippi River. I studied my ass off. I was getting this job. I was going to cross over into the A-list world. This was my big chance. I landed that audition like a 747 in these motherfucking streets. I was so pleased with myself after that scene. I tossed the script aside, slapped my hands down on the table, and said, "Now that was brilliant." The director, Robert Zemeckis, and the casting director laughed at my sassy confidence. They called me right back and said I had the job. It was thrilling to start shooting Castaway. I had studied hard and was fully confident in my lines. I felt prepared to give Tom Hanks a run for his money. Before shooting my first scene with Tom, I was getting my hair done and decided to take a moment to look over the script for Jackie's Back, the movie for Lifetime that I would start shooting the following week. I was looking at the scene where a mink hat my character wore was taken and burned. My line was, "Give me back my head, bitch!" I heard the trailer door open, but didn't look up. A male voice said, "Give me back my head, bitch!" It was Tom, peering over my shoulder and reading the first line on the page. It was surprising to see him because big stars never come to hair and makeup with the rest of us. He had his own Gulfstream trailer to dress in. "Is that in our scene?" "Oh, I'm sorry," he said. "I thought you were reading a scene from Castaway." He sounded hurt. "Wait a minute. You're getting ready to do a scene with me and you're practicing for another project?" I was so embarrassed. We got in rehearsal, and I was so nervous and over the top, he called me over to him and said, "Don't say it if you don't mean it." In the next take, I got myself together and proceeded to do the hell out of that scene. I played the role of Tom's boss at the FedEx facility where his character worked. In the scene, we'd gotten a call from Moscow that packages were not moving through and getting to their destinations as they should. We actors stood next to the conveyor belt. I heard, "Action!" and said to Tom, "You go to Moscow." As I did, boxes came up the conveyor belt. Tom, who was poised to get my goat, picked up a box, tossed it in my direction, and said, "Here's your head, bitch." Oh, we cut up on that set as if we had been raised on the same block as kids. To this day, every time I see Tom, be it on a red carpet or in a restaurant, he teases me with, "Did you find your head yet, bitch?" Filming Castaway was mind-blowing. I learned so much working with Tom. And I realized that living in my show business bubble, it had never occurred to me to think about how packages got from one place to the other. The operations of FedEx in real life are like a city with 10 zillion boxes, people, machines, and trucks. Who'd have thunk? I was blown away by that, and by the fact that nearly all my scenes in Castaway ended up on the cutting room floor. 13. Jackie's Back. I began taking writing classes for professional and personal reasons. I felt it was time for growth. I joined forces with my dear friends Mark Alton Brown and Dee LaDuke to write a movie for me to star in. I shouldn't even say we wrote it. Jackie's Back wrote itself. It was basically a compilation of fevered, insane conversations we'd had for years. We came away with a mockumentary about Jackie Washington, a 1960s-70s style R&B diva on the comeback. The concept arose from Mark and I having watched a documentary about the singer Shirley Bassey called Have Voice, Will Travel. I love and adore Shirley Bassey. I pray every night to be able to hit the notes that bitch hits and train my lungs constantly to hold notes longer than she does. Both are impossible. In the documentary, Shirley proclaimed multiple times that she was the greatest entertainer in the world. We wove that attitude along with some aspects of my personality